third case on today's oral argument calendar is number A18-1322, State of Minnesota versus Kasim. Counsel for appellant is ready. You may please state your name at the beginning, and then you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Kristen Chapman. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Kasim. Mr. Kasim's brief challenges his conviction for his possession of a firearm by an ineligible person on two grounds. I would like to focus my argument today on the second issue in Mr. Kasim's brief, the plainly erroneous admission of Sergeant Lipinski's improper opinion testimony. At trial, Sergeant Lipinski provided two opinions: that the individual in the video removed a firearm from his waistband and placed it on the shelf, and that the individual in the video was Mr. Kasim. Both of these opinions were erroneously admitted, and it satisfies each prong of the plain error standard of review.
Let me stop you there. Did he testify? I mean, did he reach the conclusions that you just stated, that is a gun, or that is a firearm, or that is Mr. Kasim? I mean, wasn't he a little bit less conclusive than that?
I disagree with Your Honor. I believe Sergeant Lipinski was very conclusive. He testified that it was not clear it was a part of my argument, and why Sergeant Lipinski's opinion fails under 701 and 702, is because his opinion was not based solely on his perception of the video. He conceded that he could not see a firearm in the video and that it was an object or possibly an item, but he conclusively says that he concluded the person in the video removed a firearm from his waistband and placed it on the shelf. And Sergeant Lipinski says,
well, I thought he said long, dark object or something like that.
If the court looks at, I believe, page 135 of the transcript, 169 and 179 all go to where Sergeant Lipinski provides the ultimate conclusion, and I'll highlight 179 particularly.
Well, it's but then let's go beyond that to the cross-examination where your client's counsel says, and I'm looking at pages 185 through 191, So your client's counsel says, Sergeant Lipinski, your sworn testimony is that you can clearly see the suspect place a firearm on the shelf where the gun was recovered. Is that right? No, sir. In fact, it isn't true, is it? You can't clearly see that. Lipinski, I was saying, no, sir, that's not my testimony. You can see that the individual places an object on the shelf, in my opinion. Then, so does that picture show a gun? Lipinski, no, it's definitely not conclusive. You can tell that it's an object here, possibly. So whatever happened on direct got cleared up on cross, it appears.
And, Your Honor, I disagree. I believe on cross it only had the effect of further highlighting the Sergeant Lipinski's opinion that was based on, by Sergeant Lipinski's own words, everything he had in this particular case, the totality of the circumstances.
But then he goes on to say, sir, I'm not saying a gun. I'm saying an item. It appears to me, and here based on my training and experience, that he's removing an object from his waistband. And as you can see, and as the jury can see in the video, his shirt comes up on one side. So he keeps saying it's an item, it's an object. I'm not saying it's a firearm.
And, Your Honor, to be clear, I believe that highlights the plainness of the error in allowing Sergeant Lipinski's opinion, because he conceded, based on his perception of the video, he could not see a firearm. Yet, he proceeded to tell the jury that he believed the individual in the video had a firearm based on his training and experience regarding the location where he removed the firearm from, being the waistband.
That's not how I'm reading this cross-examination. So I'm not seeing what you're arguing in the words of the transcript.
Okay, maybe, Your Honor, if, so I believe you said you were looking at page 191. I don't know if my
looking at 185 okay. through 191, reading parts of it.
So going off of the pages I have before me, which it seems like maybe for some reason our page numbering isn't lining up, so this may be confusing, but on page 134 of his direct examination, Sergeant Lipinski is narrating the video and says, as that's happening, a male, the defendant in this case, walks back toward a shelf and removes an item and places it on the shelf. And then he goes on to note, based on my review, it appeared to me that it was a firearm. He explains that it was based on his training and experience of where the item was removed, it was a firearm. Then on redirect, at the very conclusion of his testimony.
Can I stop you or pause you? What you just read, was that the direct examination initially?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That was the direct examination.
Thank you.
And then on redirect, Sergeant Lipinski clarifies on page 179, and you have to base your conclusions on the totality of the circumstances. Based on everything that I had in this particular case, as you can see, there was no one else around besides that female in the gray shirt who is in the next aisle over. The totality of the circumstances led me to believe that this person placed the firearm there. Sergeant Lipinski was providing his opinion that the individual in the video placed the firearm on the shelf. And I believe it was that opinion that was erroneously admitted, and I believe that error was plain because it violates the clear foundational requirements in both, whether it's reviewed as expert or lay opinion testimony, 701 and 702.
So let me ask you this. The state cites, this is an unpublished case, so persuasive perhaps. They found it persuasive. And I'm talking about the Clement case. And in that case, an officer is also narrating a video. How do you distinguish your case from that case?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, from my reading of the case, it doesn't appear that the officer's opinion about what was occurring on the video was based on anything other than his perception of the video. In contrast with Sergeant Lipinski's opinion, which is based on the totality of the circumstances, basically his entire investigation. So I think they're factually distinguishable because from reading Clement, it appears that the officer's opinion about what's occurring in the video is based solely on his perception of the video. Additionally, I do think the Clement court got the analysis wrong when it comes to the helpfulness requirement of Rule 701. Rule 701 has three different sort of prongs that need to be satisfied, allowed opinion. One of those prongs is that it's helpful to the jury in understanding the witness's testimony or an issue in fact. In Clement, when the court notes that it was proper lay witness opinion testimony, the court cites that it was based on the officer's perception of the video and it was helpful to the jury in understanding the officer's testimony for the context of the investigation and for his charging decision. The court then goes on to cite State versus Griller and State versus Check, which don't address the appropriateness of opinion testimony, but address the context argument. The Minnesota Supreme Court has been clear that otherwise inadmissible evidence can be admissible if it provides context for the investigation. So I believe the Clement Court's analysis conflated the helpfulness requirement of 701 with the context allowance under Griller and Check.
Well, so I was wondering about context here. I mean, it seems like this first came up when he was describing his investigation, maybe giving kind of a step-by-step, blow-by-blow description of how he investigated the offense. And then his, you know, conclusions or his own personal interpretation of this led to the next step. Is that accurate or no?
I would agree to a certain extent. He begins by saying his opinion during the course of the investigation, which I will address, I don't think was necessary to provide context. But then Sergeant Lipinski, on direct examination, goes into his detailed analysis of his current opinion at the time of his testimony. It cannot be said to provide context when it's not limited to a past opinion. He was providing his opinion to the jury of as he was sitting there at the day of his testimony, in specific detail, using a laser pointer at one aspect, it looks like from the transcript, going through the still photographs and the video. There was no context for his investigation.
So it evolved, perhaps, from initially talking about his perception at the time, and then you think that he gave testimony about his current view of the matter.
Absolutely, Your Honor, I do. And even if the court finds that even the past opinion testimony was not necessary for context in this situation, because Sergeant Lipinski was clear that the reason he knew which video to look at was based on the officer's initial report that included the date and time that they were informed there was a firearm on the shelf and that they collected the firearm. So Officer Lipinski's opinion about what the video showed was not necessary for context because the jury already had the context of why he was looking at that portion of the video.
Would you agree that the cross-examination by trial counsel was effective?
No, Your Honor, I would not. I do not think the cross-examination by defense counsel effectively mitigated any prejudice.
I thought it was well done, and I thought, you know, I mean, the trial lawyer went after an issue that probably needed to be addressed from the defense standpoint, and you know, effectively got the witness to say that, you know, I'm not sure. This is all I can see is a long dark object. I'm not sure it's a firearm. I mean, I thought that
got him to back off from being a firearm to being an item.
It's a long ways for a case involving unlawful possession of a firearm.
And respectfully, I disagree with that characterization of the cross-examination. Okay. I don't believe defense counsel actually got Sergeant Lipinski to back down. I believe Sergeant Lipinski just bolstered his opinion throughout the cross-examination. At one point, Sergeant Lipinski essentially tells the jury how he weighed the evidence when concluding that it was a firearm. He says, although he concedes that I can only tell it's an item, possibly an object, he equivocates. He says, I'm concluding it's a firearm based on the totality of circumstances, and points to a specific circumstance that where the individual walks is near where the firearm was found, and that there were no other items out of place on the shelf except for the firearm, which leads Sergeant Lipinski to conclude that that item is a firearm. That occurs on page 169 of the transcript. I don't believe, although Sergeant Lipinski concedes that he can't see a firearm on the video, he never backs down from the fact of his belief that it is a firearm. So in that sense, I don't think cross-examination in this case was sufficient to mitigate any prejudice caused by Sergeant Lipinski's opinion, because Sergeant Lipinski never backs down from that opinion, and it further highlights his opinion, which I believe was erroneously omitted and incredibly prejudicial in this case.
Let me ask you this. You focused on your second part of your brief, not the first part. Is that because you think that's your stronger argument?
Your Honor, I believe my brief addresses the sufficiency argument clearly, and I believe that argument is very straightforward. I do think the argument is more nuanced, which is why I'm focusing on that. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer those about issue one.
I do have a question. So your client's DNA and a partial right palm print were found on the gun slide, the print on the gun slide, DNA somewhere on the gun. Do you think that's direct or circumstantial evidence?
The DNA and fingerprint evidence in this case is not direct evidence that Mr. Kasim knowingly possessed a firearm. I think the Minnesota Supreme Court in State versus Harris was very, although the issue in that case was not whether DNA evidence was direct evidence, in applying a circumstantial evidence standard of review to a possession of a firearm by an eligible person charged, the court applied the circumstantial evidence when it involved DNA. The court, in that opinion, in the dissent, and the majority in footnote 4 specifically notes that DNA evidence is circumstantial evidence.
And of course, we have a case cited by the respondent in this case, the Jiggetts case, unfortunately also an unpublished case where the court holds, based on Silvernail's definition, in a gun possession case, physical evidence that the defendant's DNA is on the gun corroborated by uncontested scientific testimony that it probably got there by handling this direct evidence of possession.
And, Your Honor, I believe the Jiggetts court got the analysis incorrect, and I think Jiggetts is factually distinguishable from this case. Again, I think the Jiggetts court got the analysis incorrect because direct evidence is evidence that is based on personal knowledge or observation that proves a fact, if true, without any inference. Here, in a general example, DNA found on an object is direct evidence that DNA is on that object. It is not direct evidence that a person possessed that object.
Of course, we also have Mr. Mohammed telling co-worker Zini that he saw someone put a gun on a lower shelf. So we have direct evidence from those eyewitnesses, although Mohammed didn't testify.
And, Your Honor, I would, as I argue in my brief, I think this court should disregard Mohammed's hearsay statements because they are inconsistent with the verdict that the jury reached, and specifically because Mohammed, importantly, no hearsay statements came in that said Mr. Kasim placed this firearm on the shelf. If an eyewitness testified and said, I saw Mr. Kasim place the firearm on the shelf, that would be direct evidence. We do not have that in this case. Mohammed gives a description of the individual who places the firearm on the shelf. That description is inconsistent with the individual in the video, so it's inconsistent with the jury's verdict, and I think for that reason, this court should disregard all of Mohammed's hearsay statements. Additionally, some of Mohammed's hearsay statements came in through questions, which are not evidence, and it should not be considered in this court's analysis.
Back to the DNA issue. Did trial counsel cross-examine the scientist about the secondary transfer theory?
Correct, Your Honor.
There was a record made about that was part of the evidentiary record?
Yes, Your Honor. And going back to the argument of why this case is factually distinguishable from Jiggetts, the DNA in this case was not as persuasive as the DNA evidence in Jiggetts. In Jiggetts, the analyst testified that the DNA got in the gun likely from the defendant handling it, although, again, I wouldn't even call that direct evidence. But aside from that, here we don't have that type of evidence. The analyst testified that she could not be 100% sure it was even Mr. Kasim's DNA on the firearm. It was a partial major profile. It was a low amount of DNA. She unequivocally said that she did not know how the DNA got there. I realize I am out of time.
Oh, yeah, you can go ahead and complete this thought, and then I have one more question then.
I would say, even if this court finds the Jiggetts analysis persuasive, I don't believe it applies to the factual situation of Mr. Kasim's case.
Before I ask my question, I should ask Judge Riley if you want to continue with that. No. Okay. The DNA evidence is one thing, but the print, the palm print on the gun is a different thing. I'm referring now to the question whether it's direct evidence or circumstantial evidence. I mean, there is no secondary transfer theory with respect to prints, is there?
So as regards to the secondary transfer theory, there's no theory about that in the transcript. I won't opine on that generally because I'm not knowledgeable enough. But I would say that the fingerprint evidence in this case is not direct evidence that Mr. Kasim knowingly possessed the firearm.
Well, it's direct evidence that his palm was pressed against the firearm.
And again, Your Honor, I believe that requires an inference. I believe the analyst saying that she determined a partial palm print on the firearm is direct evidence that there is a partial palm print on the firearm. How that palm print got there requires an inference for the jury, which is why it is circumstantial evidence.
Well, how else would a palm print get on a firearm but for a person's touching it directly? I mean, was there anything in the record about secondary transfer of prints?
There was nothing in the record about secondary transfer of
prints. So, I mean, wouldn't the jury just have to speculate in order to interrupt that inferential leap? Inferential step. It's not a leap, I don't think.
I believe there's an inferential step. And I also, an important factor of possession of a firearm by an ineligible person requires that possession be knowing. And the rational hypothesis of innocence that we put forth in our brief talks about an accidental and brief touching. A palm print resulting from an accidental and brief touching is not direct evidence that Mr. Kasim knowingly possessed the firearm.
But it was on the slide.
I believe it was on the outside of the firearm.
But it was on the slide, that's what I'm saying, of the firearm.
And Your Honor, I'm sorry if I don't understand the distinction.
It's on the outside, but it's not like a brushing of the outside of the gun, it's a palm print.
And there was no testimony at trial about how that palm print got there and what. Although the DNA analyst opined about the likelihood of secondary transfers under hypothetical situations that were not similar to...
But that's with regard to the DNA.
And the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is that when it comes to the fingerprint analysis, no such hypotheticals were presented or opined on by the analyst. So there's nothing in the record sort of saying the reasonable of different inferences that the jury could make from a palm print being on a firearm.
So the expert didn't opine as to how you could make that print on a firearm.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So your time has expired, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Burdorf.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jean Burdorf. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota. I will also then focus my attention on the second issue, which is the opinion testimony from Sergeant Lipinski. It's the state's position, as we articulated in our brief, that this was not expert opinion, that it was, in fact, lay opinion. The first opinion identified that's challenged is Sergeant Lipinski's testimony that it was his belief based on what he observed in the video. And I think counsel gave an accurate depiction of what was happening during trial in this sense. The sergeant was essentially outlining the course of the investigation. What did you do first? What did you do second? And it's in the portion of his testimony where he was describing how he identified the suspect and how he identified which portions of the surveillance video to actually capture for evidentiary purposes, that he goes through the video and essentially narrates a fast version of the video, a slow version of the video, and then some still photographs. So that is where this challenge testimony comes from. And what he says is, it is my belief after having watched this video that the suspect is leaning over in places. So, what he says is a longer, dark-colored object. I think it is his testimony throughout, not just in his direct examination, but also cross-examination, is equivocal. It's clearly stated as, it is my belief, that looks to me like a gun. That does not sound like expert testimony to me. When we see expert testimony offered in criminal case, it is, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, it is my opinion that. It requires a level of certainty. He says, the very next sentence, after Sergeant Lipinski first says it's a dark-colored, longer object, the next phrase is, it's not, that portion of the video isn't that particularly clear. It happens very, very fast. And that sort of equivocation, it's my belief that's a gun based on what I'm seeing on this. This is why I identified this particular person as the suspect who placed the gun there. All of that, he calls it an item, an object. At one point on page 167, he said, it's on cross-examination, when he's being challenged vigorously, which each and every photograph, is this where you see the gun? He says, it's not definite and it's not conclusive. You can tell it's an object. And then he later clearly says, it's my belief it's a gun. So that first of all, I think we do have to be careful about what the opinion is. I think it was a qualified opinion. But it was met the requirements of Rule 701.
You talk about a skilled lay person, mm-hmm. and you cite to a case. That's not really something that's been picked up on by other courts.
There's not a tremendous amount of case law in Minnesota, just the two cases that are cited in the comment to Rule 701 in Minnesota. There is case law in other jurisdictions talking about the skilled lay person. That's still lay testimony. The reason that we talked about it in our brief is essentially just the fact that someone is trained and might have expertise doesn't make every opinion that they give in a particular case expert testimony. The analysis really is, you don't focus on who the witness is or what their qualifications are. You focus on the nature of the testimony that comes from the comment. And so that's really why we're talking about a skilled layperson. There are people like police officers who know things because they see it every day, but it doesn't mean that that automatically converts an opinion that they have based on what they're looking at in a video to expert testimony. It remains, even if they are considered a skilled layperson who has particularized experience, if it's not based on specialized knowledge, it is still classified as lay opinion testimony. So the requirements...
Plumbers and electricians might have an opinion on something, and that might not be clearly expert.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a danger when you have a police officer giving conclusions about what the jury can see and what he can see on a video?
I think that that's what this court said in Clement, the unpublished case that I cited. The court started its analysis by essentially saying, yes, we have to be careful when we have police officers offering this kind of testimony, but that's just an admonition to be careful. I think what we have here isn't an...
How and who's to be careful on that subject?
I think the prosecution and the district court, when they're admitting evidence at trial. I think that the testimony here...
On review, do we get to decide whether or not this was carefully done?
Yes, you do. You're the deciders. You get to decide whether it was carefully done. And I submit that it was. In this particular case, and it was appropriate lay opinion testimony. The testimony in this case is virtually identical to what happened in Clement. In Clement, it was a misdemeanor shoplifting case. There was some surveillance video. The officer in that case narrated the surveillance video and isolated a portion to identify who the suspect was. I think it was a telephone charger, and essentially said, here's the portion of the surveillance video. I think this is to the jury, where I think the crime is, and opined that based on the officer's review of the surveillance tape had concluded at a particularized moment that the defendant in that case had concealed some merchandise. Here, you have similar testimony, where the officer is essentially explaining to the jury why they isolated this portion of the surveillance video and why they identified this particular person as a suspect who placed the gun on the shelf and said, jury, I'm looking at this video. I think I see. It is my belief that this is the person who's placing the gun on the shelf at the exact same moment. That is permissible lay opinion testimony, and as in Clement, meets the requirements of Rule 701. The requirements are that it be based on personal perception.
Go ahead.
Sergeant Lipinski.
And helpful to the jury.
Yes.
And so is it really helpful to the jury to tell them something that they can see themselves?
I think it's helpful to, yes. The answer in Clement and in State versus
Or that they can make up their own mind whether that long dark object is a gun as opposed to some other long dark object. I mean, if did this police officer really have some special sense of perception that justified the introduction of his opinion about that, in addition to just the more, you know, the raw facts that there's a long dark object?
There's actually two things I'd like to answer. One is the question that you just asked me, and one is something that you said reminded me. It actually underscores the point I did want to make, which is this is not expert testimony. No one has suggested that Sergeant Lipinski had some kind of special sensory observation skills that would have made his opinion an expert opinion, which is what appellant claims it was. That's how the brief starts. This is improper expert opinion. So I want to make it clear, no one is saying that. That leads, though, to the helpfulness
other
question.
Other than the appellant.
Yeah, other than the appellant. I'm sorry if I misspoke. But that leads to the helpfulness question, which is why is it helpful to have an officer talk about what they see in a surveillance video or narrate it as when was done in Mattielli, State versus Mattielli and Clement. Why is that helpful? The reason it's helpful really depends on what a defense might be. And in this particular case, the defense is, that wasn't me first, and then it modified to, that might have been me, but I wasn't putting the gun there. I just was leaned over and I was looking for something and I might have accidentally touched the gun while I was there. Okay, so that's essentially, I didn't put that gun there. What the officer is doing in this case, what the officer did in Clement, what the officer did in State versus Mattielli, is essentially discuss and provide context for what they were doing and how they got to the conclusion of arresting and subsequently charging the defendant in that particular case. And that's exactly what happened here. If you look at the structure of Sergeant Lipinski's testimony, it literally is a chronological narrative of how he went through and investigated the case. It is important, I think, for a jury to know that in a case where identity might be an issue, as it is here, or what happened might be an issue, as it is here, how the police essentially arrived at their conclusions. I think the cross-examination in this case actually underscores why it was helpful. The cross-examination, first of all, the defense attorney questioned the truthfulness of the assertions in the search warrant that Sergeant Lipinski got for the buccal swab, and essentially said, you said in the search warrant that the gun could be seen on this video, and that's a lie, and these kinds of things. And I think when you are facing that kind of attack about essentially rush to judgment type of a defense, you didn't actually see the gun being placed there. You're making assumptions. You're not telling the truth. It's important for an officer to be able to say, this is how I progressed. I was careful. I did my due diligence throughout the course of this investigation, and this is really how I arrived at the conclusion that this was the suspect who put the gun on the shelf. So I think it does provide context in the exact same way it did in Clement and Ali.
There was no objection at trial that this was more prejudicial than probative.
There was no objection at trial. And so this is a plain error standard review, which I think, I mean, in State versus Ali, one of the cases I cite on the topic of helpfulness, that was actually objected to narration by a police officer of surveillance video. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said, nope, not objectionable. This is appropriate lay opinion testimony. And in that case, what the police were doing is trying to explain why they had excluded a particular person as a potential suspect in that case. And the Supreme Court said that was perfectly appropriate opinion testimony from a police officer in a case. Here, what really all Sergeant Lipinski was doing was not trying to offer some kind of conclusive proof. I am telling you, members of the jury, that he committed this crime and you can see it on the videotape. That is not how the testimony came out. What he is doing is describing why the steps he took in the investigation, and again, why he isolated that portion of the surveillance video as evidentiary for evidentiary purposes and why he believes that is the person who put the gun. Then you see the rest of the testimony is, okay, so now you've identified this portion of the surveillance video. You didn't know who that person was. How did you figure out who the person was? Did you interview the person? What kind of forensics did you do? So it really is just a component of the overall context of the investigation, and I do think that that meets the helpfulness requirement of 701. So, again, is it based on personal knowledge? It is. This was Sergeant Lipinski's testimony about what he observed and the conclusions he drew during the course of his investigation about what he saw on the surveillance tape. Was it helpful to the jury? I just touched on that. The third requirement of Rule 701 is that it not be based on specialized knowledge. This really gets to the point that you raised a few moments ago, and I tried to address, which is, he is looking at a videotape and describing what conclusions he drew from the videotape in the course of his investigation. What you see in that videotape doesn't require any kind of specialized knowledge or training, so it certainly doesn't fall under, it's not expert testimony, it doesn't fall under Rule 702. So I do think, in this particular case, this testimony did meet those criteria, but we really are on plain error standard of review, and I don't think, even if you were to conclude you might have made a different ruling or that this might have been error, I don't think it is clear or obvious error that would warrant a reversal based on that particular standard.
I watched the video. How would you describe the quality of the video?
I actually probably thought the video was a little bit better than Sergeant Lipinski did. I watched it 3 or 4 times yesterday, the fast and slow version. I think it is pretty definitive that the defendant walks up to the end cap of that, leans over, pulls out something long and black. It looks like a gun to me when I stopped my computer, and I think that that's sort of consistent with what Sergeant Lipinski said. It looks like a gun. The police are in that gas station. The defendant leaves, and within moments, they recover a firearm hidden behind some snacks on that end cap. I don't think that I need to detail the sufficiency of evidence in great detail, but I do think the video, in addition to the DNA, and the palm print on the slide, which I think it's fairly obvious, a palm print on the slide of a gun, which is on the top of a gun, and what you do to rack it, probably gets there only one way. I think all of that evidence is conclusive of appellant's guilt. It's our position that the district court didn't engage in plain error when they allowed Sergeant Lipinski to offer this kind of opinion testimony during the course of trial. It's also our position that the evidence was more than sufficient, regardless of what standard of review you apply, is more than sufficient to support the conviction. We'd ask that you do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burdorf. Ms. Chapman, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
I'd like to start by addressing the state's argument regarding the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State versus Ollie. I believe the state misstated the court's decision in that case. In that case, there was two opinions that were at issue. One was the officer's opinion about who was depicted in video surveillance. And the court there expressly said it was not making a ruling under either 701 or 702. Purely based on the context argument, the court found it was admissible. And again, there's this conflation between the helpfulness requirement of 701 and the context. Those are different analysis for this court, and the court should view those differently. Under 701, to meet the helpful requirement, it must be helpful to a clear understanding of the witness's testimony or determination of a fact and issue. Here, Sergeant Lipinski's opinion about what occurred in the video was not helpful because the jury was in just as good a position as Sergeant Lipinski to watch the video and draw their own conclusion.
So your argument that the district court plainly erred by letting it in implies that there was a point in time when the district court should have intervened without an objection and said, stop, don't go any further, so on. I mean, because you're familiar with the record, I'm wondering if you can pinpoint exactly when that time occurred. I mean, in other words, because I think you said earlier, maybe in response to my leading question, that his testimony evolved a bit from, you know, describing his investigation and describing his prior observations or prior understandings to describing his current views of the matter. But when did that occur? Can you give us the transcript page?
Yes, Your Honor. And maybe I should clarify my response to the court's earlier question. When Lipinski first gives his opinion, he's doing it present tense. He's narrating the video of what he is currently perceiving in the video. And so I believe that that is takes it out of the context argument. Additionally, even if it could be limited, I don't think it was necessary to provide context because of the reasons why I stated earlier. However, I do think, Your Honor, once Sergeant Lipinski gets into the details and starts going through the still photographs, which I believe occurs on page 137 is when the photographs are first introduced, and I think around 143 and 144 is when he's narrating the video surveillance. And I believe it's at 144 when you can tell he's using a laser pointer. Sergeant Lipinski was going through a detailed analysis of what he was observing and his opinion of each of those photographs. That was a determination for the jury. And what was a particularly prejudicial in this case is Sergeant Lipinski's had the effect of communicating to the jury that I reviewed everything I had in this case, the same circumstantial evidence that you are going to be reviewing as the jury, and I have concluded that Mr. Kasim is guilty. That substantially influenced the verdict. It's yes,
okay, before time expires, I wanted to ask another question. We haven't talked at all, I don't think, about the third requirement of the plein air test, whether his substantial rights were affected, whether this evidence affected the verdict. Can you speak to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's where I was going. Sergeant Lipinski essentially gave an instruction manual to the jury about how the jury should interpret the entirety of the state's case. And for that reason, this court can't sort of parse out Sergeant Lipinski's opinion from the rest of the evidence. His opinion permeated the rest of the state's evidence. And this court in State versus Hogtvedt has clearly recognized the particular sway that law enforcement officers have when it comes to jury deliberations. Here, Sergeant Lipinski was presented as an experienced officer, 14 years on the force, recently promoted to sergeant, the lead investigating officer in this case. And that had the effect of communicating to the jury that he viewed all this evidence, weighed the evidence, the same evidence that was presented to the jury, and he concluded that Mr. Kasim was guilty. There is no doubt that that influenced the jury's verdict. And the reason why this is so problematic and the reason why a new trial is required in this case is because it had the effect of usurping the jury's role as a fact finder. Essentially, rather than aiding the jury's assessment of the evidence, Sergeant Lipinski's opinion replaced the jury's assessment of the evidence.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, except here we must have also had an experienced prosecutor, because in closing, the prosecutor didn't say, you heard what Sergeant Lipinski said, the prosecutor said that the jury had to, now I'm quoting, to review the entire incident in conjunction with witnesses' testimony, identification evidence, physical evidence, forensic evidence, both fingerprints and DNA when evaluating what the video surveillance tape shows. And you all can go back and you can parse out whatever is in that video and decide whether or not you see or don't see a gun, and that's subject to interpretation.
And Your Honor, my response would be that was one aspect, but again, on page 268, which was another part of the state's closing, the state references all the evidence the jury should view in connection with the video, and then the very next sentence says, as Sergeant Lipinski stated, you have to view them, referring to the video, in conjunction with all the other evidence and make a conclusion, essentially communicating to the jury that just as Sergeant Lipinski viewed all of the evidence in this case and concluded Mr. Kasim was guilty, the jury should do the same. And that, I think, had a significant influence on the verdict and warrants granting Mr. Kasim a new trial.
If the officer had curtailed his testimony to your satisfaction, we still would have the DNA and palm print evidence and the testimony of other witnesses and so on, right? I mean, there's other ways in which a jury could say he's guilty.
Your Honor, I do believe the sufficiency of the evidence is different from the harm analysis here. And because Sergeant Lipinski's opinion was based on all of the evidence, it tainted how the jury viewed that evidence. So even in light of other evidence that was presented, Sergeant Lipinski's opinion was a powerful and persuasive impact. Additionally, the jury had doubts about the forensic evidence in this case. During jury deliberations, they submitted a question asking whether any DNA or fingerprints were found on the magazine of the firearm, clearly showing that the forensic evidence found on the outside was creating doubt in the jury's mind. Here, I think it's reasonable to conclude that Sergeant Lipinski's opinion is what helped alleviate that doubt. And for those reasons and the reasons in our brief, this court must grant Mr. Kasim a new trial.
Thank you. Thank you to both lawyers for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.